Gun Violence Archive had never logged a month of 60-plus mass shootings before 2020. It happened 5 times in 2020, 6 times in 2021, and now 6 times again this year. According to Gun Violence Archive, the U.S. has experienced an average of 1.68 mass shooting incidents per day so far this year. The 2018 Small Arms Survey found that there were approximately 393 million firearms in civilian hands in the United States, or 120.5 firearms per 100 people. That number is much higher now, given the soaring increase in gun sales in the past few years. U.S. President Joe Biden in July admitted that a flood of guns was turning American communities into killing fields and vowed to reinstate a ban on assault rifles. The remarks came in a White House ceremony to mark new gun control legislation that President Biden signed on 25th of June. Biden said, "This has taken too long with too much of a trail of bloodshed and carnage. The past many years, across our schools, places of worship, workplaces, stores, music festivals, nightclubs, and so many other everyday places, they have turned into killing fields." The Tehran Times has also covered the same story. Amid growing political polarization, more Americans are buying guns amid a climate of fear and insecurity. The United States has marked the third consecutive year that the country has registered more than 600 mass shooting incidents. The spike, documented by a prominent non-governmental organization, comes as a record number of Americans purchase guns amid a political landscape that fuels fears of violence amid growing polarization. The Gun Violence Archive has labeled mass shooting incidents as an American phenomena and defines the deadly incidents as any attack in which there are at least 4 victims shot, injured, or murdered by a gun, but excluding the perpetrator of the attack. The latest statistics paints a disturbing picture of increasing gun violence in a country where there is so much political division that American news outlets are openly speaking about the dangers of a civil war. The latest figures have also been released as Donald Trump has announced his candidacy for a Republican presidential nomination in 2024, nearly 2 years after inspiring the deadly insurrection on Capitol Hill. The former president and his supporters strongly believe that the U.S. election was rigged in favor of his rival Joe Biden. Among Donald Trump's supporters are white supremacists and other armed extremist groups. Trump received more votes in the 2020 presidential election than he did in the 2016 presidential election. In 2020, the Republican candidate enjoyed the support of more than 70 million Americans, an indication of how many of the American public maintained support for Donald Trump's views and rhetoric. It also shows how polarized the United States has become. This is despite the many challenges facing Donald Trump, including the latest FBI raid on his Florida residence at Mar-a-Lago that angered his fan base, who have also expressed their strong belief in voter fraud in the last election. Experts say the deep divisions in the country, alongside the vast mass shooting incidents, will likely spark further turmoil in U.S. politics and potential violence among voters of the Republican and Democratic parties. The Insider website has also covered the same story and gives us more details. Following the Colorado shooting, President Joe Biden urged the country to address the public health epidemic of gun violence in all of its forms. President Biden said, Earlier this year, I signed the most significant gun safety law in nearly three decades, in addition to taking other historic actions. It has been very clear that Biden's most significant gun safety law in nearly three decades has had no effect on the increasing figures of gun violence, as 2022 is set to go down in the history of the United States as a year during which the second highest number of mass shooting incidents took place. The other problem in the U.S. is that with the National Rifle Association, NRA, an extremely powerful gun lobby in Congress that advocates for the right of U.S. citizens to carry weapons. Opinion surveys show that only 52% of the American public actually support any form of gun control. According to polling by Gallup, only 11% of the population say that gun laws should be made less strict. Experts say this shows an environment of insecurity and fear that Americans live in. Not only are Americans concerned about political violence and the future of their democracy, but also the rising rate of crime in the U.S. Gun ownership significantly increased over the last few years. Earlier this year, research by the Annals of Internal Medicine found that 7.5 million American adults, under 3% of the population, became the first new gun owners between January of 2019 and April of 2021. These are the latest statistics from the Gun Violence Archive as of 24th of November 2022. The total number of deaths as a result of gun violence that involved all causes stood at just shy of 40,000 deaths, with 39,845 incidents documented. Homicides, murders, and unintentional deaths stood at 18,197. Suicides using firearms stood at 21,648.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is for a better life for IRIB English Radio. I am Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol, and one of my specialties is in enhancing the style for living. And my talk is based on the Quran and Islamic tradition. In this episode of the program, I am going to be going over trusting God in difficulties. Difficulty is an inseparable part of our life. Hardship is a part of our daily life, and we cannot keep them away from ourselves. There is not even one person who is 100% free from the hardship of this world. Now, what is the solution? Can we let these problems take our patience away? Can we run out of hope and tranquility? Of course not. When we believe that Allah is there, it should be enough for us. Then we have to trust Him. We need to realize that even the slightest thing in this world would never take place without the permission of Allah. Without the permission of God, even one leaf does not fall from the tree. No one and nothing can move, and no good nor bad action would take place. This is a fact. Imam Sajjad, or fourth Imam, when he faces a hardship, says to Allah in one of his supplications, وَبِقُدْرَتِكَ أَوْلَدْتَهُ عَلَيَّ O Allah, if I am stuck in this difficulty, You with Your power decided to direct it to me. وَبِسُلْطَانِكَ وَجَّهْتَهُ إِلَيَّ And with Your mastery over everything, You allowed it to come to me. Then the Imam continues, وَلَا فَاتَحَ لِمَا أَغْلَقْتَ وَلَا مُغْلِقَ لِمَا فَتَحْتَ no one can open what you has closed, and none can close what you has opened. وَلَا مُيَسَّرَ لِمَا عَسَّرْتَ. No one can make easy what you have made difficult. These are the facts. I recommend everyone to read the entire of this supplication, which is full of many monotheistic points. And the Imam accentuates on the fact that everything in this world is in the hands of Allah. If we have faced a severe difficulty, this difficulty did not come upon us without Allah's permission. Now let's have a glance over some verses of the Quran. We read in the story of the Israelites at the time of the Prophet Moses, when they escaped from the Pharaohs, or Pharaoh and his army, under the leadership of Moses, it was night. Pharaoh and his army learned about the escape of the Israelites and started chasing them. The Israelites suddenly reached the Nile River. It was really predicament since they could not move forward because in front of them was water, and they could not run away to another place because the Pharaoh and his companions would reach them sooner or later. The hardest difficulty that could be ever met. When the Pharaoh and his army approached them, got near them, we read in the Quran, فَلَمَّا تَرَى الْجَمْعَانِ قَالَ أَصْحَابُ مُوسَىٰ إِنَّا لَمُدْرَكُونَ. When the two hosts sighted each other, the companions of Moses said, indeed we are overtaken, we have been caught up. Now let's have a short break. I will be come back and continue talking about this story.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome back to the program For a Better Life. We were talking about the Israelites at the time of Moses when they escaped and the Pharaoh reached them. They said, we have been caught up. But Moses, who had a complete trust in Allah, told them, كَلَّا إِنَّ مَعِي رَبِّي سَيَهْدِينَ. By no means, not at all. Verily my Creator, Allah is with me. He will guide me. He will tell me what to do. Then we read in the following verses that Allah told Moses to strike the sea with his stick. So the sea was divided into two parts and the Israelites passed through it. Let me focus on this point, that the verses of the Quran and these verses indicate that God can offer a solution for us even in the most severe problems. The verses of the Quran are not only stories and storytelling, but also are for learning and understanding. As a result, we can also in difficulty should say, إِنَّ مَعِي رَبِّي سَيَهْدِينَ. Allah is indeed with us and never leaves us alone. Allah will show us the right path and the way of solution. Another example of trusting Allah in hardship is seen in the final part of Imam Hussein's life in Karbala, before he get murdered. Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, in his final talk to Allah, and that moment when he was on the verge of martyrdom and knew that as soon as he was martyred, the enemy would attack his household, the women of his family, and those who were with him of women and kids in Karbala. The enemy would attack his children, would take them captive. At that time, when Imam Hussein's companions, friends, and his men and relatives were murdered, at a time when the thirst had reached its peak, now just imagine the situation, he addresses Allah with the words that shows his utmost patience and submission to Allah, says, Sabran ala qadaika ya Rab, I am patient to what you have decreed, O my Creator. La ilaha siwak, there is no God but you. Ya ghiyath al-mustaghithin, O the only assistant for those who need help. Ma li rabbun siwak, there is no other owner, no other supervisor for me but you. The word Rab, which is one of the attributes of Allah, means the observant owner, a caring supervisor, supervisor of the universe. Here, when the Imam addresses Allah by this word, he wants to say that I know that all of these difficulties that I am facing is not out of your control. Here, the Imam considers Allah the owner and trainer, someone who is well aware of what is happening to his servant and what is good for him to happen, what is best for him, for his servant to face. Now, all the difficulties of Imam Hussein passed, but his name and his goal are widespread. His divine reward is high and his bilad has never been wasted. The conclusion is that we in difficulty have to trust Allah, have to be submissive to his decision. We should trust him. And we need to realize that what Allah decides is always in our favor, whether we realize the wisdom behind it or not. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we followed Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the south of Iran and saw the most amazing combination nature could match together, the desert and the sea. We also met the region's native inhabitants and got acquainted with their unique lifestyle. Stay with us as Javad travels to other villages of the region to discover the culture and customs of the people.
In the past, staple grains for all of Iran came from Sistan and Balochistan. But what for severe drought spells and misguided planning over the years, the province has completely lost that status. But today, in some areas of this province, and in the Bahu Kalat district in particular, all kinds of vegetables and tropical fruits are cultivated. There is a mango tree that's in full bloom, exploding with blossoms. In about 5 months, they will turn into delicious, juicy mangoes. This is heaven indeed. Walking around in the palm groves and other gardens in Bahu Kalad gives me a lot of peace. One of the most beautiful things I come across during my stroll is the Baluchi squirrel. The Baluchi squirrel, also known as the stripy or palm squirrel, is a unique species of rodents living in parts of Iran, Pakistan, India, Nepal, and Bangladesh. The most distinctive feature of this mammal is the dark stripes on a white background on its back. In the past, the inhabitants of Sistan and Balochistan believed these stripes were the fingerprints of the gods. A typical Baluchi squirrel is between 13 and 15 centimeters from its head to the end of its rump, and its tail adds an additional 14 to 19 centimeters to its total length. It's quite refreshing to see Baluchi children playing and gallivanting around in the banana groves. Beautiful, pure souls, the product of their serene, peaceful surroundings. Children of Shir Gwaz spend the whole week waiting to go to the fruit groves near the village to expend some of their inexhaustible energy. What they also do is they cook their traditional food on their own, and just like their elders, they gather around, sing, and play. The kids here have distinctive, innocent faces. They are just gorgeous. And they're all wearing their traditional costumes, boys and girls alike, all wearing traditional clothes. They are among the oldest, most original tribes in Iran. They're very noble and very patient. They are a people with a lot of patience. And although some of them don't have good living conditions, they are very patient folks. They're so content. The Baluchi culture is the perfect example of a culture of nobility and peace. And those cultural traits are readily visible in the architecture of the old houses in this village. The architectural design is endemic to Balochistan. You can't see anything like this anywhere else in Iran. There are also new houses in these areas with designs influenced by Indian and Pakistani cultures and architectures. One of the characteristics of Baluch families is their large populations. Wherever in the village I go, I'm surrounded by many of the little angels offering a breath of fresh air after a long day of hard work. They fill my heart with peace and joy. Perhaps one of the reasons these kids are so happy is their beautiful, tranquil, natural environments. Just as influential is the beautiful, happy colors used in the clothes that these little girls have on. Clothes that are embroidered by the artistic hands of their mothers. Hand embroidery on colorful clothes and fabric is among the most important crafts of Baluchi women. And fortunately, Baluchi women have been able to preserve this exquisite art, a skill handed down through generations. It's noontime. It can get really hot in Shirguaz, even in the middle of winter. But the boys of the village have a good solution to fighting the scorching heat. What they do at a time like this is jump into the waters of Shirguaz River and swim to their heart's content. These children usually play together in groups. The day offers an opportunity for me to make a return to the beautiful carefree days of my own childhood. Live life as an uninhibited, unabashed explorer of the unknown. Playing with these children serves as an outlet for the negative energy in me. Although the children in Shirguaz don't have much to entertain themselves with, they're all growing up happy, healthy, and strong by playing in groups and making the best of what their natural environment provides them with. No computers to spend the whole day on, playing virtual computer games that don't involve any physical activity, video games that have taken the place of playing outside for many kids today, outdoor experiences in nature, and plenty of physical activity that a growing body craves. These children's only toy is nature, going up trees, diving into the river and swimming, playing with animals, singing songs and helping their parents at home and on the farm, frolicking around and playing with stones and pebbles. This non-stop joyful mobility is the reason behind these children's physical health and happy disposition. Very soon, I leave the village and set out for my next destination. I have to travel 250 kilometers to the west of Baluchistan, to a place 80 kilometers north of the city of Nikshar, a name that reminds me of my country's beautiful north. Given its unique geographical location, Baluchistan has a diverse and strange climate. Some parts of this area is affected by the tropical climate of India, in the south by the Sea of Oman, in the west by the Jazmurian inland basin, and in the north by Lut Desert. Surrounded by these different climatic conditions, Baluchistan features diverse lifestyles and various plant and animal species. Baluchistan is a dry, water-thirsty land. The average annual rainfall in the province is around 110 millimeters. But the important thing is, all that water comes down in only a couple of torrential rainfalls that cause the rivers in the province to overflow their banks. The ensuing flooding leaves behind a trail of destruction every time. The people here tell me they get snow and blizzards in some winters, too, because of the mountains in the Gorgan area. Perhaps you'll find it interesting to know there is a place named Gorgan in Sistan and Balochistan province. But no, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the city of Gorgan in the north of Iran. This area is comprised of around 11 villages punctuating this mountainous area. It can get freezing cold here. The people of Balochistan say, except for Mount Taftan and Mount Basman, the only other place where you can see snow in the highlands is the same Gorgan region in Balochistan. It can get really cold here. Because of the altitude and the relatively good rainfall here, this valley usually has a good amount of water, and abundant water means life and prosperity. The people of Gorgan are either farmers or orchard owners or livestock keepers. The most important thing for them to be able to do any of those things is to have clean drinking water. The people of the first village I visit are very kind and hospitable. In my conversations with them, I realize all the young people in the village are busy working simply because there is enough water. Everyone has something to do. They're all grateful to God for all their blessings. Their biggest asset is contentment. I could say most of the things I've seen in this village were built from scratch by the men and women living here. They're all content with what they have. They even have electricity. They live a beautiful, simple, and healthy life, away from the hustle and bustle of city life and excesses that distract human beings from their true self and from nature. The Baluch community leads a simple lifestyle in their simple homes in Balochistan. They don't even expect a paved road. The peace that these lovely people exude is a breath of fresh air against the vicissitudes of city life. I am so at peace when I am in their fold. Before long, I resume my journey and arrive in the village of Archenik, a bucolic settlement second to none. But it isn't the architecture and natural environment that lends Archenik its beauty. The most beautiful thing I come across is the hospitality of the local inhabitants. Archenikis are hard-working, hospitable people. Moments after I reach the village, one of the elders comes to welcome me and invite me to his beautiful house, and the family gives me the red carpet treatment. Personally, I have a lot of respect for the culture and customs of this lovely ancient tribe and have tried my best not to have a negative impact on the culture or any of the good social norms of this community. Instead, I learned from them things that I had no idea about before I met them. I have had many trips to far and exotic places in Iran. And on those trips, I saw many and varied village houses and nomad tents. But nothing like the teeps in the Gorgan region. Beautiful, modest homes that offer peace and tranquility, just like their natural surroundings. Village elder, Pir Muhammad, fills me in on how they build their houses. My trip is nearing its end. That means I have to leave the beautiful Sistan and Balochistan province and head back home. I leave with a bag of experience and memories as sweet as the dates of Gorgan. And I do so knowing that I haven't done any harm to the natural environment and the culture of this ancient tribe.
I'm quite sure that this week's documentary about Iran's natural wonders intrigued all our audience across the globe, and I hope it inspires you to come and explore the hidden treasures of Iran. And that's it for this week. Do keep in touch with us, and until next week, goodbye.
In the limelight.
Over 400,000 Yemenis have perished since the US-backed Saudi-led coalition war broke out in 2014, making it the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe, according to the UN. While US President Joe Biden pledged to end the war in Yemen, he is doing the opposite. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, "Since 2014, thousands of Yemenis have suffered and died. President Joe Biden's pledge to end offensive weapons transfers to the Saudi-led coalition soon after taking office was insufficient to end the war. A mostly successful truce earlier this year recently expired, and violence has escalated. The time for more definitive action is now. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, long a leader in Congress for ending U.S. support for the war, is pushing for another War Powers Resolution vote on Senate Joint Resolution 56. He has 13 co-sponsors, all Democrats at this point, though the 2019 vote did garner significant Republican support and should again. The title of the measure, a joint resolution directing the removal of United States armed forces from hostilities in the Republic of Yemen that have not been authorized by Congress, makes it intent clear. Congress, which the Constitution explicitly gives power over matters of war, has never approved U.S. participation in the war in Yemen. While the emphasis needs to be on ending the suffering of Yemenis, symbolized by the slogan Yemen can't wait, political crosswinds could play an unpredictable role in any upcoming congressional votes. The U.S. House of Representatives could schedule a vote soon after a successful Senate vote. House Joint Resolution 87, introduced by Oregon's Peter DeFazio, has 118 co-sponsors, including 10 Republicans. Saudi Arabia's terrible human rights record and its highest mayor of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, as well as thumbing its nose at President Biden last summer when he embarrassingly beseeched it for help in lowering oil prices, are surely negative factors. However, the Saudi lobby is very powerful in Washington and beyond, and its influence on Congress should not be underestimated. We will soon see if Democrats are ready to essentially rebuke their president on this issue. Partisan loyalty cannot be allowed to override the suffering of the people of Yemen. Biden has plenty of time to shut this war down, but has failed to do so. Congress must act and is on the solid ground in terms of its constitutional authority. Meanwhile, a Mehr news agency reported two civilians were killed and seven others were injured in the Saudi coalition artillery attacks on Sa'deh province in north of Yemen. The U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition targeted areas in Manbe and Shada cities in Sa'deh province with artillery attacks. According to the media report, two civilians were killed and seven others, including an Ethiopian migrant, were injured in the attacks of the Saudi coalition on Sa'deh. Yemeni sources also reported recently that the Saudi army shelled the Arab area in Manbe district in north of Sa'deh, during which a Yemeni citizen was martyred and 12 other people, including a number of African immigrants living in Yemen, were injured. The Saudi regime launched the devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistical support from the U.S. and other Western regimes. The objective was to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of former President Abd Rabbo Mansur Hadi and crush Yemen's Ansarullah popular resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen. While the Saudi-led coalition has failed to meet any of its objectives, the war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and has spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary. The Prophet asked those who had been wounded in Uhud that day to gather, and they did. He told them to go confront the enemy. The Muslims went, defeated them, and returned. So they returned with favor from Allah. They obtained a large amount of spoils from the battle, and no problem arose for them. They defeated the enemy and returned. This is a divine tradition. So if in the face of the enemy's intimidation, you truly have faith that Allah is sufficient for us and He is an excellent trustee, and if you do your duty, this will be the outcome, the victory. This part of the chapter, Al-Imran tells us this tradition. This is what happened after the Battle of Uhud. Perhaps this was about a few hours after the end of the Battle of Uhud. The other case was related to the Battle of Uhud itself. In the Battle of Uhud, the Muslims were victorious in the beginning of the battle. First, they attacked and crushed the enemy. But when they neglected this strait because of worldliness, the situation became reversed.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Again, in chapter Al-Imran, the Quran states that, and certainly Allah made good to you His promise, chapter 3, verse 152. God fulfilled His promise to you. He had said, we promised that we will make you victorious if you struggle on the path of God. He carried out His promise. When you slew them by His permission, chapter 3, verse 152. You were able to put pressure on the enemy and to defeat them due to God's grace. You succeeded in the beginning of the battle. So God did what He had promised in this part. God kept His promise to you. But what did you do next? Instead of being thankful for this divine promise and giving thanks for this divine grace, until when you became weak-hearted, when your eyes saw the spoils of war, and that some people were collecting the spoils, you became weak-hearted, and you disputed about the affair. You started to argue and disagree with each other. You see, you must look at these Quranic phrases from a specific sociological viewpoint. See how a country, a state, a government can progress. And on the other hand, how it can be stopped and how it can fall.
In the United States, Katie McEnany, a former White House press secretary, has been described as a liar and an opportunist by a former aide to Donald Trump. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Katie McEnany, Donald Trump's final White House press secretary, is a liar and an opportunist, according to testimony to the House January 6 committee by Alyssa Farah Griffin, formerly a communications director to Donald Trump. In testimony released on Thursday, 29th of December, Alyssa Farah Griffin was asked where McEnany fell after the 2020 election. Either, hey, we lost, let's gracefully exit, versus, let's facilitate the big lie that Donald Trump's defeat by Joe Biden was caused by electoral fraud. I'm a Christian woman, Alyssa Farah Griffin said, so I will say this. Katie McEnany is a liar and an opportunist. McEnany, who became a Fox News host after leaving the White House, did not immediately respond. Alyssa Farah Griffin now works for ABC. She also said McEnany was a smart woman and not an idiot. She knew we lost the election, but she made a calculation that she wanted to have a certain life post-Donald Trump that required staying in his good graces. And that was more important to her than telling the truth to the American public. McEnany has often addressed the issue of whether she lied while working for Donald Trump. When she first stood behind the White House podium in May of 2020, she promised to tell the truth to the American press. A reporter asked, "Will you pledge to never lie to us from that podium?" McEnany replied, "I will never lie to you. You have my word on that." She has repeated the claim, saying in June of 2021 she never lied as press secretary. McEnany also released a highly selective memoir, "For Such a Time as This, My Faith Journey Through the White House and Beyond." The book repeats the claim she never lied to reporters, in part because her education at Oxford, Harvard, and Georgetown meant she always relied on truthful, well-sourced, well-researched information. Katie McEnany also spoke to the January 6 committee. In its report issued last week, it said a segment of her testimony seemed evasive. In multiple instances, McEnany's testimony did not seem nearly as forthright as that of her press office staff, who testified about what Katie McEnany had said. The committee also noted that though McEnany disputed suggestions that President Trump was resistant to condemning the violence and urging the crowd at the Capitol to act peacefully when they crafted his tweet, at 2:38 p.m. on 6th of January 2021, one of her deputies, Sarah Matthews, told the Select Committee that McEnany informed her otherwise. Griffin, who left the White House in December of 2020, told the committee she did not confront McEnany while both worked for Donald Trump, adding that she got her Fox News gig. It worked out precisely how she'd always planned for it to, but she knew better. Griffin also described the chaotic workings of the Trump White House, which she called the flattest organization I've ever worked in, meaning the one with least distance between staff at the bottom and the top. She said Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's final chief of staff, meant to control access to the president, was a true believer to the end. Griffin told the committee, I would see press assistants in the president's personal dining room and not know how they got there, a press assistant being a very junior staffer. Accounts of senior staffers' attempts to control access to Donald Trump are legion. According to a book by Stephanie Grisham, Kylie McEnany's predecessor as press secretary and a longtime aide to the First Lady Melania Trump, one press aide in particular caught Donald Trump's attention. Stephanie Grisham wrote, I began to notice that he was taking an unusual interest in a young, highly attractive press wrangler on my team. What I do know is that he behaved inappropriately, and since the woman worked for me, I tried to protect her and keep his unusual interest in her under wraps. According to Stephanie Grisham, Donald Trump told one of her deputies to bring the woman up to the office cabin on Air Force One so he could look at her. Grisham said she came close to telling Melania Trump about such behavior, but was not alleging that anything happened between the president and the woman. It would have been pretty hard for him to pull that off, even if he wanted to, she said. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. Former Trump White House Communications Director Alyssa Farah Griffin called former White House Press Secretary Kylie McEnany a liar and an opportunist in her interview with the House Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Alyssa Farah Griffin's scathing view of Kylie McEnany, her former colleague, was included in a batch of interview transcripts released by the House panel on Thursday, 29th of December. In the interview, Farah Griffin criticized Kylie McEnany for helping perpetuate the notion that the 2020 election was stolen. I'm a Christian woman, so I will say this. Kylie McEnany is a liar and an opportunist, Farah Griffin said in her April interview with the committee. She's a smart woman. She's a Harvard law graduate. She knew we lost the election, but she made a calculation that she wanted to have a certain life post-Donald Trump that required staying in his good graces. She said McEnany wasn't a true believer in the idea that former President Donald Trump actually won the 2020 presidential election. After leaving the Trump administration, McEnany secured a job as a contributor to Fox News Channel. Farah Griffin pointed to her new cable news spot in her interview with the panel, saying she got her Fox News gig. It worked out precisely how she's always planned for it to, but she knew better. Farah Griffin, who is now a co-host of ABC's The View, said she thinks most people around Donald Trump know that the former president lost the 2020 presidential election. The only people I think are true believers are like Dan Scavino, John McEntee, Mark Meadows, to some degree, she told the House panel. Farah Griffin resigned from the Trump administration in December of 2020, just weeks before the official end of Donald Trump's term in office. She told the website Politico in January of 2021 that she stepped down because I saw where this was heading and I wasn't comfortable being a part of sharing this message to the public that the election